Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloudonaut podcast. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Wittig. We have been building on AWS since 2009. Follow along as we develop products like BucketV, Marbot, and HyperEnv and learn from our practice. This is episode number 92, and we are recording this on October the 10th in 2024. In case you're watching this live on YouTube or LinkedIn, feel free to ask your questions in the chat. We will either pick them up directly or at the end of a topic or the end of the show. So, Andreas, it's time to talk about AWS again, right? I think we have a long list of stuff because we had a long pause here with the podcast. So what's the first topic that you want to talk about today?
Yeah, the first one is about Terraform. And the thing is, so we use Terraform besides CloudFormation a lot, Michael. And from time to time, with all those infrastructures, code tools, you run into issues where you basically want to create or manage a resource, but it's not yet supported by your infrastructure as code tool. So that happens with Terraform, it happens with CloudFormation, and it's always frustrating, right? Because you're trying to achieve something, want to use a new or newish feature, but you can't because your infrastructure as code tool is not supported. And I was running into such an issue with Terraform recently, and by accident, actually, I found a workaround, and this is what I want to present here. So the thing is, Michael, I don't know if you remember, but in 2021, AWS announced what they call the Cloud Control API. And the idea behind this is they wanted to publish an API that infrastructure as code tools can use in a standardized way to create, update, delete, list, and get resources on AWS. Because the issue with all the other AWS APIs is they are very different. So the EC2 API is different from the RDS API. So the actions that are available, the different possibilities are just, there's no standardized way of doing it, right? So the idea is to bring a little bit of standardization into the whole thing, and then by that, making it easier for those infrastructures code tools to build their resources or to integrate with the AWS APIs. And at the beginning, I remember that we both were very disappointed by the Cloud Control API because it started by covering I looked it up. It started with covering something like 300 resources, which is a small fraction of the whole AWS ecosystem. But the good news here is that this improved quite a lot within the past few years. So the good news here is that nowadays the Cloud Control API supports more than 1,000 AWS resources. So that's not too bad, actually. And also, someone is working on that. So the if you go through the change logs, you can see that they are constantly adding new resources and expanding them. So every week almost, you can find new resources added to the API. And infrastructure as code tools like Terraform can use the API definition, and they do it to basically generate their infrastructure as code. For Terraform, it's called a provider, automatically based on the API definition. And that's why they can very quickly keep up to date with the Cloud Control API. For Terraform, there is usually you use the AWS provider, which gives you access to many, many AWS resources. But there's also the AWS CC for Cloud Control Terraform provider available. And this gives you access to all the resources that are available through the Cloud Control API. So this is very handy. So maybe first of all, how do you use this AWS CC Cloud Control provider? It works almost identically as you use the AWS provider. You define it in your Terraform configuration. You configure things like the region. Also, credentials work the same. So I used it with dynamic credentials. It works similar. And then you define your resources. And of course, the resource definition is different, but there is documentation pages for all of those things as well. So it's very convenient to use them. So the question is maybe, what is the difference between the good old AWS Terraform provider and the AWS Cloud Control Terraform provider? And so what I did is I compared the number of resources that those two providers support. And that's interesting. So the AWS, so the old the provider that's been there for years, supports 1,424 resources. So of course that's a snapshot from a few weeks ago, but that's around about the number of resources supported. The AWS Cloud Control Terraform provider supports 1,023 resources. So the gap is not too large anymore, and they're catching up, I would say, based on the release notes that I went through. And maybe even more interesting is the data resources when you compare those two. So the AWS provider comes with about 600 data providers, and the AWS Cloud Control Terraform provider comes with 1,800 data providers. So basically for every resource, you have a provider to list the resources and to get a single resources with all its attributes. So that's what you get out of the box, and that's not available for all the resources in the AWS provider. However, so I stumbled upon one important issue when we talk about data resources. The AWS CC provider, the data resources, they require you to provide a list of IDs to fetch multiple resources, or the concrete ID to fetch one resource. They do not support fetching resources by any attributes. So that's what we typically do with data providers in Terraform. I don't know, you want to get the default VPC in the account, then there's a data provider, a data resource for that. Or I don't know, you want to find an AMI with a specific name, I don't know, something like that. So all of that is not possible with the data resources of the AWS CC provider, because the API only allows you to fetch those resources by their ID. And that's typically not what you already have. those data providers are not too useful, probably. So at least I cannot really think about many use cases for them. So that's that part. Then I had another look. So I tried to figure out, so when it comes to new features of AWS, typically the problem is that Terraform and CloudFormation do not support them out of the box. And so I looked into features where Terraform is missing the resource for managing the new feature. And I found three of them. I listed them in a blog post that we will link in the show notes later. And for all three of those, there was no... I went through the issues in the Terraform AWS provider, found the missing resources, and then I checked if the AWS CC provider already has the resources released. And I found three examples where this is the case. There are probably much more, but I went through a few examples. So it seems like this can be a very good option. If you need a resource that is not available in AWS provider for Terraform yet, you can check out AWS CC, and the chances are that there you will find what you are looking for. So this is good news. I think that probably has something to do with a policy at AWS that they, because they built CloudFormation based on the Cloud Control API as well, and they try to release new features with CloudFormation support. I think that's probably why many of the new features have Cloud Control API support, and therefore also Terraform AWS CC provider support already. So what you can remember is, So if you are looking for something that is not yet available in Terraform AWS provider, check out the AWS CC provider and you'll probably find what you're looking for, or you have chances of finding what you're looking for there. At least that was the case for the issue I was running into. So I tried to set up a code build compute fleet. This was not yet supported by Terraform AWS back then. And I found out that it is supported by AWS CC. And last but not least, it is not an issue to mix both providers. So you can use the AWS provider like you have been doing for years, and you can just bring in the AWS CC provider as an addition to your Terraform configuration. It works seamlessly. So this could be a good option to use the new provider. There's one more thing I want to mention with AWS CC. So for Terraform, there are linters available that check if your configuration makes sense. And for AWS CC, I couldn't find any validation of the values basically that you hand over as properties. So I was running in more issues where I tried to basically call the API with invalid parameters or properties. So this could be an issue. So it's probably not worth switching completely from the AWS provider to AWS CC, but to use it as an addition. So that's at least what I will do in the future, to use the AWS provider for what is possible. And then for those resources that are missing, I will look into AWS CC. So that's about the Cloud Control API and its journey over the past 3 years. So I'm actually quite excited about what happened there. So that's really cool.
Yeah. I think that's a great tool in your toolbox if you're using Terraform. So just remember that. The next time you find something unsupported, you can use the AWS CC provider. Yeah, that's great. Okay, Andreas. The next topic that I picked is migrating from Amazon Linux 2 to Amazon Linux 2023. So Amazon Linux is the Linux that AWS releases, and they also support it in their support plans. And we, from the very beginning, I think we used Amazon Linux. Back then it was Amazon Linux, which then was renamed to Amazon Linux 1. Then we switched to Amazon Linux 2, which was kind of a bigger change. And now it's time to migrate to Amazon Linux 2023. So one thing to remember, this is again a deadline. So we talked about this a little bit before we started with the show. Amazon Linux 2 runs, or end of life is end of June next year. So June 30 in 2025. So before that, you should upgrade to Amazon Linux 2023. Or maybe you can already start using the next version of Amazon Linux. I'm not sure how quickly that will be released. But for now, Amazon Linux 2023 is the kind of latest version of it, and it is supported for 5 years. So I think it makes sense to migrate to it, even though it's 2024 now. There are a couple of changes, but I don't think they are so important, to be honest. So one of the changes that is nice to know is actually that SA Linux is now enabled by default, and it runs in permissive mode, which basically means that it doesn't block anything. It just locks all the violations. So you can, if you wish, use it or continue to use it. I mean, we for many, many years, we heard people want to use it, and then we just always told them, don't use it on Amazon Linux. And now you actually can. So if you wish, you can do it. But by default, it will not get in your way. So you have to enable it. And there's documentation around how to do that, actually. So that's one point. The other point is that they switched the package manager from YUM to DNF, which from a user perspective, it works kind of the same way. DNF install, you install a package. So for most people, it works very similar. One thing that changed that you have to kind of familiarize yourself with is the way that you update it. So make sure that you read the documentation, how that works. The other thing that might impact you if you are installing packages from the APL repository, the APL repository is not supported anymore. So it was not supported by Amazon Linux 2 at the very beginning, as far as I remember, and it is not supported by Amazon Linux 2023. And if I read the documentation correctly, they don't have any plans to do it because it's not possible from a technical perspective for some reasons that they mention in the documentation. So I don't expect this to change as far as I understand the documentation. But in our case, that wasn't a big deal because the only package that we installed from the APL repository is a package that we actually also plan to not install anymore from the APL repository. So we wanted to install it from source. And this, in this case, particular case, it's the ClaimAV engine for our BucketAV product, the malware solution for Amazon S3. So with the migration to Amazon Linux 2023, we also kind of migrated ClaimAV from an older version to the latest 1.4 kind of family. So that's it. One nice benefit that you get when using Amazon Linux 2023 is that it should actually boot quicker. And I don't have concrete numbers for BucketAV because it's really hard to measure because a lot of things are going on when we start up the system. And the question is, what do you measure? Do you measure until the operating system is ready and the user data script runs, or what's the time you compare? And then we also see some variance between starts of instances. So you actually have to launch a couple of instances with the old and the new version to actually get valid data. And I hadn't had time to do that. But from what I observe, it is actually quicker. And that's a good point, especially for our use case, Andreas, where we want to have auto-scaling in place to kind of adapt to the capacity and very quickly launch instances. And for my observation, it is actually better compared to Amazon Linux 2. A couple of reasons, AWS also goes into details in the documentation about that if you're interested. One kind of thing I was running into is that the way the logging works is a little bit different compared to before. So on Amazon Linux 2, by default, you have your /var/log directory where you see all the files, and all the logs go into files, basically. In Amazon Linux 2023, if you check out the var log directory, there's actually not much in there. And there's just a readme that says, okay, we don't, by default, write to to files anymore here. Use journal D or journal CTL to get access to the logs. There is documentation around how to actually get back the files in Varlog if you wish. You just basically run a couple of commands and that's it. So if you want to get back to before, that's possible. But I thought, okay, maybe we should kind of accept the future and kind of work with it. So I was looking for a way to get the logs into CloudWatch logs, because that's what we were doing before. We kind of used the files in Varlog directory and kind of streamed them to CloudWatch logs using the CloudWatch logs or the unified CloudWatch agent, as it's called today. And unfortunately, there are no files anymore, right, Andreas? And the CloudWatch agent doesn't support reading from journal D directly. So another tool is needed. So there's no kind of sane way of doing it, except for writing to files and then streaming to CloudWatch logs, which doesn't make much sense as far as I think. So I was looking for alternatives, and I mean, there are a couple of tools that can do the job, a couple of GitHub projects and so on, but I was not so happy with those projects. Some of them are really old, like 5-6 years old, and they're maintained by one person. So I found a project called Vector, and it's from Datadog. And this is a company that is in the observability space. And basically this little tool provides the capability to read from many sources and push to many targets. I think they call it syncs, if I remember correctly. But doesn't matter. Basically, there's a source and there's a destination. And the source can be a file, or it could be journal D. And the destination can be many things, including CloudWatch logs. So basically, I configured Vector to kind of ship the logs directly from journal D to CloudWatch logs. And it's working. I mean, the format is a little bit different and things, so you can tweak it if you wish. You can add metadata and things like that. It's actually quite flexible. And that's what we do now to get the logs back into CloudWatch logs, Andreas. Once it's running, it's actually a nice little tool that hopefully does what it is intended to do. So we haven't heard any complaints about it, and we don't see any issues with it. And it's around for quite some time. So I think it's kind of the thing the Datadog uses to get all the data from the machines into their systems as well.
Yeah.
So it seems to be quite stable as well.
Yeah. So Michael, it's really cool that you have been going the extra mile here to find a replacement tool to ship the logs to CloudWatch from JournalD. Because what I was doing when I ran into the issue for another project, I was just enabling our syslog again, which is then basically shipping the logs to the files again. I'm really happy that you found a solution for that. And I think many others will profit from your learnings here as well when upgrading to Amazon Linux 2023.
Yeah, and it actually also makes sense to kind of get used to Journal ZTL to get access to the logs. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are good, if you know the flags, so the most important one is the minus U flag for the unit. So you can, for example, in our case, Journal ZTL minus U bucket V, you get only the logs from bucket V. Minus A, go to the, I think minus A is go to the end of the log file, and then there's minus X, I think, for streaming logs and things like that. So I can't remember them anymore, which is a bad sign, Andreas, but at least everything is there. There's no need for tail F. There is something like that in Journal CTL. There is something like crap in Journal CTL. Everything is available. You just need to adapt to the new way of doing it. And once you do that, it's great.
So as we more and more also get into system D, as those two components are basically connected or combined, so it makes a lot of sense.
I'm learning system D. I bought three books here in my bookshelf, and I actually try to read one hour a day in those books.
Okay.
It doesn't work well, Andreas, so
it's not the most exciting topic, maybe, Michael. But it's an important topic, definitely.
Yeah.
So learning more
about the fundamentals. I already learned something, and I already improved our product with the learning. So it's actually nice to know the things that you're using, right? So it always makes sense to understand what's going on. Yeah.
Yes, that helps, Michael, as we learned so many times. Okay, anything to add about Amazon Linux 2023 or...?
No, not so far.
Okay. Perfect. Okay, so let me continue with the next thing. So I learned about. So I looked a little bit more into code build in the past weeks, especially because code build now also supports running GitHub runners, also GitLab runners, by the way, directly on code build. And that, by the way, I also learned how that works. So what they basically do is CodeBuild has been a service that worked together with CodePipeline and all the other code services by AWS. CodeCommit is now deprecated, but it also was linked to that. And you basically can run your CI/CD jobs on CodeBuild. And the problem with that, so why we moved away from it, is that you didn't have the whole experience in one place. So you had your code build or code pipeline on AWS, but you had your code on typically on GitHub, and it was always a little disconnected. So now we use GitHub and GitHub Actions to do our CI/CD. With the support of running GitHub, using CodeBuild for GitHub runners, so native GitHub runners, self-hosted GitHub runners, this made it interesting for me to look into that again. And so what I learned is basically you can connect CodeBuild with GitHub, and then basically a GitHub webhook starts a CodeBuild build. This then starts the image that AWS maintains, where they install the GitHub runner and then start the GitHub runner, which then connects to the GitHub API. So that's how the thing works overall. But that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about what AWS, a feature of CodeBuild that is called compute fleets. So basically, you can reserve your own compute capacity for your CodeBuild projects. And then when a CodeBuild build starts, you're not getting assigned one of the available resources in the huge pool from AWS, but you basically have your own instance running. And then if that instance is free, it picks up the next CodeBuild job that is coming in. And I was using that feature to speed up the time it takes for registering a GitHub runner that starts on code build. Because if you have your own capacity, this gets a little faster. And also, as multiple jobs then run on the same instance, you benefit from caching on the instance. So that's the important part that I was running into, because I had to download a container image every time the code the job starts. And the code build compute fleet, basically what you do is you configure that, the size of the instance, stuff like that. And then typically this runs 24/7, and you pay then, of course, for 24/7, you pay for the instance that is running, no matter if you run any jobs on it or not. So that's a little, of course, the downside on the pricing, from the pricing perspective. And as in the project I was using this code build, the developers are working only during typical business hours here in Germany. So there are no international teams. All the team members are located here in Germany, and they work typically between 9 and 5, and they do not work on weekends. So I was looking for a way to reduce costs a little bit and basically only use the compute fleet during business hours. Also, if jobs are running outside business hours or stuff, it could just run them on demand on the large fleet that CodeBuild uses typically. So that's also not an issue. I wanted to quickly bring up the solution for this that I'm using now. Is we're using Terraform and a GitHub action that basically runs in the morning and in the evening of each business day. And with this GitHub action, we are triggering Terraform and setting a parameter that enables or disables the compute fleet automatically. So by doing this, we spin up the compute fleet in the morning. It takes a few minutes before it comes available, and then we shut it down in the evening. So we only have to pay for the reserved capacity that speeds up our CI/CD jobs during the business hours, which is a huge cost saver, and we are not wasting any resources 24/7 here. So I found this quite an, if you're using GitHub Actions or any other way where you can trigger jobs easily, you can use Terraform and those automations to spin up and tear down those compute fleets for CodeBuild. Actually, I think it should be a feature of CodeBuild itself, because probably most teams don't use their CI/CD platform 24/7, but yeah, that's not available. So this is what we ended up with.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. And I was just checking, Andreas, while you were talking, if application autoscaling does support it, but it doesn't. So I think that would be the service that cares about it.
I think there is an autoscaling option available, but you cannot scale to zero. I think the problem that you have. So I think there's, I read about some way to scale it, but not to zero. So yeah, that's the issue we had.
I see.
So that is it. And by the way, so there was an interesting fact. So while we were using Terraform to spin down and configure the compute fleet, and you have to configure your code build project as well, because there you have the connection between the fleet and the project. And we run into an issue with the code build API. Basically, one of their checks was wrong, and we couldn't turn it off and on via the API, because there was an issue with the API. And I had a really pleasant experience with AWS support and the service team, because I reported this issue by opening a support ticket. A few hours later, I got response from the support engineer who said, I have basically replicated the issue. I confirmed the issue. I will forward it to the service team. And one day later, I think it was 2 or 3 days later, he wrote back and said, the service team has fixed the issue in the API. It's now rolling out over all the regions. It will take a few days until it arrives in Germany, in EU Central 1. But I was really surprised how fast they responded. So first of all, the support understood my problem and forwarded it to the service team. And then the service team fixed it really fast and has already delivered the change. So this was a really cool experience. Like back in the days when we started with AWS, where every interaction with AWS support was like that. So I really enjoyed that. Yeah, really, really
That's
cool.
That's great. Okay, Andreas, do we have time for another topic or should we close it?
So I think one more because it gets old a little bit.
Okay.
So let me do that. So I want to basically give a summary of a conference that I went to. Forward CloudSec was taking place for the first time in Europe in Brussels. And this is a really cool conference. Because it is a community-led conference. So it's not like basically it originates from a meeting at Reinforce, from the security community at Reinforce, because they were frustrated with the AWS conference, which was so focused on selling basically all kinds of solutions to make things more secure. And they wanted to establish a community-led conference that focused more on the technical details. Mm. So now this is coming to Europe, which was cool. And I was going there, and we even sponsored the conference with Bucket AV. So this was also a nice experience. And I just wanted to highlight and pick three of the talks that I found interesting. I will link them, and you can watch them. The recording is available on YouTube. And that I recommend to check it out. So one talk from Sebastian was very interesting because he showed examples of how basically attackers managed to break into systems running in the cloud. And he had a few examples what happened there, and was also mentioning that they are observing that more and more attacks really go into the details of the different cloud providers. So based on his data, he said a few years ago, security issues in the cloud on AWS or elsewhere were typically, you had an issue with your software running on a virtual machine, and this was causing the breach. But there was nothing happening from that machine breaking out into your, for example, AWS account or something. And now they observe more and more attacks where an attacker is, for example, infiltrating your EC2 instance or Lambda function, but then that doesn't stop there, but then uses the IAM permissions to go to the next service to get more permissions and stuff like that. So I found that quite interesting. So I would recommend to check out this talk. The other talk that I found quite interesting is, Shelley, she was doing research about basically infrastructure as code tools. And she tried to find out ways in her example with Terraform, how you can steal credentials with Terraform code. And really, really interesting what she was able to be doing is, so for example, if you have a Terraform module that you use, you have to be very careful because it's possible that you have something in that Terraform module, in that Terraform code, that sends your AWS credentials to a backend somewhere. So because there are possibilities with Terraform and how you can use DNS lookups and stuff like that to get out data from Terraform to another system somewhere else, so the attacker can get access to credentials, for example. So this is really wild. I didn't expect that. So of course, you have to check Terraform modules that you're using, but I never looked into such details to, so this is really important and an issue. And the third talk I want to recommend is about undocumented AWS APIs from Nick. This is not really something that affects my daily work, but it's just interesting that AWS has a lot of undocumented APIs. Typically, these are APIs that they use for, it seems like they use it for testing, for betas and something. And those are publicly available. And as you can imagine, so there are really a lot of them. So he has techniques to find them, basically. And in his talk, he talks about that. And then, as you can imagine, those are not the production APIs, but some of them are able to modify production resources in your account, and then they're not going through CloudTrail or or other things. So it's really interesting that there are those undocumented APIs. And as you might imagine, they are not that well reviewed and secured as the production APIs. And there's a lot of things that can go wrong there. So interesting and a little bit frightening that those are available out there. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the three talks I would recommend from Forward CloudSec in Europe. So we will link them in the show notes for you to watch them. Highly recommended. Okay, Michael. So I think then that's it for today. We'll be back soon. Subscribe to the Cloud On Out newsletter, the podcast, or the YouTube channel to make sure you're not missing the upcoming shows. Also, we are looking forward to your feedback. Hello@cloudonout.io or find us on LinkedIn and Mastodon. And as always, you will find the show notes, or all the links in the show notes and the video description. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for joining.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.